have a very special guest, my friend River Page, who is a writer. You can find his work over at Twink Rev or at Spiced as well. Thank you so much for coming, River. It's super exciting to talk to you, especially post cancellation. The last time I saw you making waves, you were angering people on Twitter and getting canceled. What happened with that whole thing?
The last one? Yeah. It was people were mad because I said, what did I even say? It was something about like the non-binary thing. I think I was making fun of Demi Lovato, perhaps. I'm not quite sure exactly what people were mad about. But it had something to do with, I can't even remember the initial tweet because I deleted it after people got so mad. But I was basically just saying that it's a thing that like nobody can question, and you kind of just like, oh shit. Okay, we can cut this if you want. I remember exactly what I said now. and it's, oh, by the way, it's Spliced today, not Spiked.
Oh, sorry, Spliced today, not Spiked. Sorry, I'm like, yeah. So
Spiked, it's turned into Spiked now.
I'm sorry, I've like sedated myself with chamomile tea and like magnesium, so I'm like not even really here. But yeah, go on, what were you saying? What was it that you said?
So I said that the non-binary, I asked the question, like, when so many people who identify as non-binary just present in a totally, typical way, how is that transgressing the gender binary? And people got mad about it.
But I mean, isn't it like a valid question that would like require measured like analysis, but even like a measured response, or even like an open invitation for conversation? But this is Twitter we're talking about, so of course that's like not going to be the response. But it's still a shame to me, because I didn't see what you said as this like major affront in the way that a lot of people seem to. It seemed like you're just genuinely curious and like had a question that like most people, it's like a public secret that like most people think in the back of their heads but feel too like afraid to ask, or like inhibited out of the fear that you might be encroaching on somebody's sort of like personal like self perception. But I don't know, my whole thing is I think there are people who are genuinely like androgynous beings in a way that isn't like, because I think everybody's androgynous to some distinct or another, but I feel like there are certain people who are like genuinely androgynous beings, and that's how they feel, and that's like how they present. But then what I've also noticed is that like a lot of men who have injured masculinity or have some kind of traumatic experience around it, or have some kind of like discomfort, instead of like troubleshooting and like dealing with that discomfort that they feel, they just sort of latch on to this label, and that underlying discomfort is still there. So they end up acting in all these like pernicious, like toxic ways. And that's kind of been like my experience with some people, not all people. There are people who are obviously comfortable with who they are, whatever, but there's like a subset of people who sort of latch onto the label as like an excuse to like not deal with other issues they may be having.
Right. And I've had people who say, I may look like a man, I may like present as a man, but I don't feel like a man. And a lot of times these are like gay guys. And I'm like, well, of course you don't. Like, you know what I mean? It's like, yeah. Well, I don't think anybody does, but like, especially like, gay men. But it kind of seems to me, if you take, for instance, Tilda Swinton, who I have a lovely portrait of on the back of my wall. You take, somebody like her, and then who just identifies as like a middle-aged Scottish woman, and somebody like Demi Lovato. I mean, clearly one of these people has transgressed the gender binary in a very interesting and compelling way, and then one of them not. One of them is person who failed to make her drug addiction into good art, which is kind of like the worst thing that you can do as a musician.
Yeah, very, very true. Very true. But then again, I mean, there's also the sort of thing that people say that, oh, it shouldn't be based around like external signifiers that it's just your sort of inner reality. And it's like, well, in that sense, there's no way to kind of quantify or measure that in a way that would have any sort of real political significance in that sense. Yeah. Yet it's still being sort of pushed forward as this like very politically significant thing that sort of makes them distinct enough to be like a protected class, which is, I don't know, I don't understand.
Well, it's become a discrete category unto itself, which kind of seems to destroy the point, don't you think?
Like,
I'm not a man, I'm not a woman, I'm non-binary. It's just like you're just creating another category of person. It's like you're still being defined by something. I think if you... And it also kind of brings into question, like, this whole idea of, like, you know, we are in a place where, as, like, a society in the West, where these traditional motions of, like, masculinity and femininity don't really have any basis in, like, the material reality, because everyone is pretty much just working in these, like, service jobs, even automate, sort of manual labor jobs. So much of it is automated that it doesn't really require that much like physical sort of strength or anything like that. So it's hard to, what it meant to be a man in like the industrial age, and the purpose that being a man and being masculine served, no longer really serves any sort of like economic or material purpose. Everyone is becoming sort of non-binary in a way because the need for gender is sort of going away.
Yeah.
And it's not because of radical, Marxist, like socialism or, protests or activism or anything like that. It's just the advancement of capitalism, which I think is something that these people who, all claim to be radicals are having trouble coming to terms with.
But that's the thing.
It's the advancement of both. It's like capitalism and science, because science is like filling the gaps with a lot of like, the actual biological need for the difference of men and women. Now you can just like get some sperm at a sperm bank or like get your,
eggs
thing
frozen.
Or a surrogate or anything. Yeah. There's like so many different ways that are all like really medically safe now.
It's interesting though, because the left, like these left people or whatever, the sort of radical contingency seems to, a lot of their sort of cultural agenda always seems to kind of work in tandem with whatever the system is already doing. And especially around like the depolarizing of gender, which Pahlia has a very interesting criticism about, like she's not against it, but when these things happen, we have to sort of troubleshoot the natural problems that like arise as a result of those things. She has this sort of idea of like Mother Nature is like an authoritarian. And whenever we break one of Mother Nature's rules, we have to, find a way of mitigating the consequences. Otherwise, it causes problems. And that doesn't mean we shouldn't break Mother Nature's rules. We should, because that's what evolution is. It's about, breaking nature's rules and advancing. But when we do break those rules, we need to figure out like, the consequences of that and try to troubleshoot and mitigate the consequences of that. And like what I'm seeing is us sort of willy-nilly breaking nature's rules and not troubleshooting any of the fallout in a way that creates a bunch of unhappiness for people of all genders and like sexual orientations, this sort of rapid deterritorialization and like cultural schizophrenia. And I mean, of course, in the material realm, like in the workplace, gender is like depolarized, but In the home, one of the things that I'm starting to notice is that the older I get, the more pronounced gender roles begin to become, especially in my own personal household and relationship. Like me and Jake have been together for like 7 years. So we were together from when we were like 19. And like when we first got together, we were kids basically. So we were the like androgynous little creatures in that sense. Like there wasn't that sort of super defined sort of gender role thing. But as we've gotten older and more responsibility, those gender roles just sort of naturally kind of fall into place in like heterosexual relationships, and not in like a toxic way. It's sort of like a, in a way that like is just kind of like unconscious almost. It's not something that you like can plan for or like predict.
Yeah. I think like kind of the idea that like, and this is like me speaking as like a gay guy who like really doesn't have any skin in the game. but I think this idea that, you know, traditional gender roles are somehow, I mean, there were like cultural practices like that arose from like patriarchy that were oppressive. But if you think about, you know, the sort of middle class housewife of the, you know, 60s, 50s, 60s in the United States, I mean, there was never a person who was more free, really, to pursue their own individual desires and exploits, like within a, you know, a certain framework. You know, those people, you know, those women, to a certain extent, because technology advanced to such a point that, you know, doing laundry and doing the dishes and cooking and all those things, like, you didn't have to spend all day doing that. They had all this free time to pursue leisure and you know, different hobbies and activities and stuff. And of course, like, I think that also did lead to like some consequences, because in suburbia, at least, because you had that coinciding with the breakdown of the sort of extended family, you know, multi-generational households and so forth. And just, you know, a broader sort of community. Everybody's living in their own little, you know, McMansion. And so, you know, these women became, like, oppressed. That's when, like, you know, things like Prozac and such, like, started becoming more common. And in a way, I think we're all sort of, like, you know, and I think that Adam Curtis made this point in his latest documentary, but we're all kind of becoming these middle class housewives now, just perhaps with like a lower standard of living. Because we're all atomized and we don't we have all this free time to pursue interests, but we don't have anything to look forward to.
He said it. He said that the sort of 50s housewife was like the experimentation ground for the kind of alienated time and atomization that we're currently like experiencing as like a collective in that sense. But yeah, it's interesting to me how, you know, like I said, the cultural agenda of the left seems to currently constantly work in tandem with like whatever the system is doing, and it sort of poses itself as radical. And whenever people sort of try to troubleshoot or ask questions about these sort of cultural things, then they get their heads chewed off. And I saw some of what was going after you, and you had to like lock down your account. Like, really and truly, it's conversations we should have. And I want to hear dissenting opinions. I want to hear what people like have to say. But Jake, as the resident straight white man on this show, what is your opinion on all of this stuff?
What about like the non-binaries and stuff? I mean,
look at the fear in his eyes right now.
Yeah, because I mean, I'm not even an online person, so I'm afraid that if I piss people off enough, they'll just like track me down in real life. But you know, I think your inner feelings, they're not really going to be able to be like expected to be known or like, you know, even respected to a degree, like you know, by a large amount of the population, because everyone's got an internal struggle, and sort of it's kind of hard to sort of swing like, I've got this special feeling that makes me not feel like a man, but like I present completely normally. You're just like, well, I mean, yeah, today being a man, that can mean lots of things. So I'm sure most people, as you said, River, like, you know, don't quote unquote feel like a man. Does everyone feel like fucking Joe Rogan? Like, probably not, you know?
Does but Joe like, Rogan even feel...
I think like, he's like the 21st century quintessential male. Like, absolutely. He like embodies that like archetype or whatever in real life,
I guess.
Is
it though? Because there are all kinds of different archetypes though.
Dude, he hunts. He like, fights and shit.
I think he's like he's into comedy. I think he's like a throwback to kind of an old school version of masculinity in that's sort of trying to find a footing in like modernity. I think it's up to every person to define what it means for themselves and to really think about it, you know, and to excavate it.
And these ideas are also contingent with time and culture, even within sort of the same culture. Because I think about like all of these sort of like quote unquote like based like posters on Twitter and like blue checks, even to a certain extent. Like there's a sort of subset of those people who are always talking about masculinity or whatever. Like, you know, maybe like the pinnacle of this would be like Bronze Age pervert or something, you know? And I grew up on like a farm in East Texas. And if, wow. Yeah, my dad. Yeah, my dad's a log truck driver, and wow. Everybody else in my family is like either a union electrician or like a construction worker, and or a farmer. And so, like, if they met like some fucking effete Yale political science student who's like posting pictures of Abercrombie models all day, they would be like, "Oh, he's a faggot."
They think that was they would
like they wouldn't definitely. Like that's not like they wouldn't read as masculine to them.
Yeah, or, like it's LARPy.
I mean, even just like thinking about masculinity is, I think, kind of a little bit gay, but
yeah,
like, you shouldn't care about if you're a straight man, you shouldn't care about it.
Yeah,
you
that's definitely how I feel about it. Is I don't think about it like any unless someone brings it up or you ask me or something like that. It's never something that really enters my mind. But
it's even happening among women now. There's this whole like femininity craze where women are sort of doing this whole throwback to kind of like golden age Hollywood femininity, like the Lana Del Rey, like weepy eyed starlet type of thing is like very sort of popular at the moment. And it's LARPy. Like most people don't think about it. And like, even if they feel some element of like discomfort or alienation with the mainstream narrative of what's like considered feminine or masculine, it's not like what dominates like their entire consciousness if they don't already have some kind of issue with gender, like dysphoria or this or that.
I think a large part of what contributes to it is that anytime it feels like masculinity is like even mentioned or talked about in society these days, that it's like negative, that it's like it's a bad thing that needs to be like nulled down, like it's some sort of ADHD kid that needs to be given Ritalin or something. You need to tame it because it's just out of control, and it's the one of the biggest reasons for all of society's
problems. It's part of the reason why I'm even sort of like somewhat skeptical about the way a lot of liberal feminists talk about the concept of patriarchy, TM, because to describe all of human history as patriarchal is ahistorical. Men and women, especially men and women who were not part of the ruling class, like upper echelons, have historically collaborated and have basically done whatever role they needed to do in order to sort of support and sustain life. And of course, there were like societal mores around those things, but those societal mores also sort of grew out of material realities, biological realities a lot of the time. So that's the reason why, like, men die to protect women and children, and everything they do is for us, which is the reason why I'm sort of reluctant to kind of paint history as like this completely like reactionary force, even though there is obviously like harmful and oppressive like notions that have arisen out of that culture. I don't think the way we troubleshoot or like fix that is by sort of superimposing this like completely negative view of like history. You know,
right? And I've got like 2 points on that. One to what Jake said, and like one to what you said. I think the when it comes to like discussions of patriarchy or masculinity as it being coded as negative, I think that's true. But I also think that it is class sort of contingent as well. I know it's like kind of popular in some of the circles that we run in now to kind of shit on Chapo, but Amber Lee Frost is like one of my writing inspirations. She's brilliant, I think. Probably one of like the greatest social critics of our generation. And people make fun of me for saying that. But she has a wonderful essay in The Baffler called Daddy Issues. Or I'm sorry, this one. Yeah, that one's Daddy Issues, I think. But it's about how when the sort of like critique of the sort of mainstream feminist critique of masculinity, when they talk about that, they're not talking about their men. Like, the professional class women who sort of self-identify as feminists and, like, put out all this, cultural production around, you know, the horrors of masculinity, they're not talking about the men that they date, the men that they marry, the men that raise them, because those men are white-collar, sort of effeminate in a sort of way. They, they don't... they're very gentle. They, like, do their fair share of the child rearing and the chores and the income. It, maybe they'll even make less than their wives or whatever. What they're talking about is, like, working class men, the men who deliver their groceries and their Amazon packages.
Build their houses.
And build their houses. And
keep the electricity grid running and, you
exactly,
know,
exactly. They're
all
talking
the...
about those men.
Yeah.
That's most men.
And
yeah.
Which is most men, yeah. They're talking about men who are not initiated, and even if they respect women, and most of them do, men that are not initiated into this ideology, which has really outlasted its usefulness. Quite honestly, the feminist critique is no longer useful. Because of the advance of technology and the advance of production. But in any case, I think that, like, women, especially a lot of downwardly mobile, sort of middle-class women are... when they have this, that sort of trad thing, as you were talking about, Angie, the sort of Lana Del Rey, submissive, like, wanting to return to, like, a more simple time or whatever. I think that that's because for that particular class of women, and even working class women to a certain extent, like, we used to have, at least in America, we used to have, like, a segment of the working class that could afford for a wife to stay home. My grandfather was a union electrician. My grandmother never worked. She was valedictorian of her class, brilliant, incredibly smart, taught herself piano when she was 10, taught herself Spanish, was a brilliant writer, never worked. Because her husband had a, you know, blue collar union job and she didn't have to. And so she stayed home, she raised the kids and she was happy. But that is no longer an option. So these women who at one point would have had the option to pursue a career if they wanted, or simply get married, have kids, pursue their hobbies, or do whatever, that's no longer an option for them.
No.
And so you see it kind of spill out into art and into cultural production, because I think people are really, they really sort of miss that. Even if, you take into account, like, oh, it was like, you know, back then, if you didn't have a job, you couldn't get divorced, you know, because then you wouldn't have any money or whatever, or you'd have to worry about alimony payments and blah, blah, blah. That was, you know, the whole Betty Friedan, like, second wave feminism, like, sort of critique of, like, the housewives. But everything comes with trade-offs, you know?
Yeah,
it's like, well, now you make your own money, but you are not enslaved to your husband. You're enslaved to your employer.
Yeah, well, exactly. You're enslaved to your employer. And that's the thing, it's the concessions that were even made for women's rights in the first place was because of the utility of women in this sort of new wave of capitalist production and evolution in that sense. So it wasn't this sort of, like, benevolent kind of, like, totally innocuous thing, even though, of course, it had good results in that sense. But really and truly, the primary reason that those concessions were even allowed in the first place was because of our utility to, like, the productivity of, like, capital and stuff. And then secondly, there's this really interesting book I've been reading called A Billion Wicked Thoughts. And it's basically like a case study of women's activity on the internet. And they sort of split it up into demographics. And among that sort of upper middle class, women, their major search history for sexual things and like porn was all domination fantasies or the fantasies of being rescued or, you know, rescued by someone in that sense. And I feel like there's sort of a shame that a lot of women carry these days about those kinds of traditionally feminine proclivities. And you're sort of told that you're not supposed to want that because that's like desiring like oppression or desiring, you know, to be under someone's boot in that sense.
Well, that was the old school feminist critique is that what was her name? Andrea, of course I'm going to blank.
Andrea Dworkin
and women like that who were, you know, they were like, they even went to the point where they were teaming up with like the Christian right. And like burning porn in the streets, like Playboys and stuff like that, because they were like, you know, it's the domination of women and blah, blah, blah. And now the sort of social mores of like that same sort of, you know, class of people is actually, no, you shouldn't kink shame. And I think it's a sort of tacit admission that you need a sort of outlet for these desires.
Sort of Thonian subterranean desires. And you're right, they do sort of make their way into our cultural production. Like the reason someone like Lana Del Rey exists is because she's feeling that, she's tapping into that like feminine, you know, Thonian kind of desire. And it's sort of like a cultural... It's like the same thing that Madonna did in the 80s in that sense. It's like she's tapping into that sort of like subliminal kind of cultural like desire. And I mean, personally, like in my own life, like I'm very comfortable with my feminine proclivities, and even the ones that are like more traditional. But I feel sorry for men because even just psychologically, as a man, if you're born a man, you are in the realm of the mother up until you're like viable, able to talk and walk and stuff. And then you are sort of transitioning out of her social role into a completely different one. Whereas as a girl, you're sort of mimicking your mother's social role and you're not having to have that sort of painful transition like away from it into something like completely different. And I mean, the reason why society and culture created men. I mean, there used to be initiation rituals for a boy to become a man. The reason that they created men is because we needed men to provide, to protect, to hunt, to do all of those different things. So there was a process of sort of taking the boy out of that like Oedipal realm and socializing him into the world of men. But it seems like that sort of process is no longer viable, and women still have their like little comfortable thing on the side.
And that's interesting. And of course, like all things lead back to Lana Del Rey.
But of course, if
you think about, for instance, like everyone hated her for all the critics hated her first couple of albums. I think feminists got the most angry over Ultraviolence, which is a genius album that I have this recurring fantasy where it's actually released after Me Too officially begins, because I mean, it was ahead of its time. I mean, there's literally a lyric in Cola, I think it is, that she says like, Harvey's in the sky with diamonds and he's making me crazy. And of course it was completely misinterpreted.
My God.
Like she was talking about like women using their sexuality to get ahead, which is something that's considered sort of, I mean, I'm not saying whether it's right or wrong, but considered unacceptable now, at the same time that it's okay to do sex work, because of course, like, you know, the professional class women don't want other women who are willing to sleep with men to get ahead to be competing with them, but they're perfectly okay with, you know, poor teenagers like prostituting themselves or, you know, whatever. But if you think about like the first album that the critics actually liked of Lana Del Rey's, it was Norman fucking Rockwell. The first song, Norman fucking Rockwell, everyone thought that it was that song, particularly in the whole album, was kind of, I think, as Jack the Perfume Naturalist put it, like, man-hating, but it's not. It's people, it's about, you know, men not living up to their roles and like to what is expected of them. Like, that's what the entire album is about. And I think that the whole like it's man-hating thing, I think that that was actually like kind of a little bit of a cope for them liking the album. I think they wanted to say like, oh, well, she's finally ditched this anti-feminist thing and she's hates men now. Your poetry's bad and you blame the news or whatever. And it's like, no, she's complaining about like men not being men. She's not complaining about men being too masculine or being too tough or being too domineering.
Yeah, it's true. And I mean, that's part of what as much as the you know, modernity has shifted stuff, I think part of what people are afraid to troubleshoot, especially in the heterosexual world, is how these shifts affect the frisson that exists between men and women. And I think a lot of the frustration that you're seeing in that sort of liberal feminist realm is a frustration that frisson, that like frisson that was like so palpable in like, you know, prior periods of human history is now sort of depolarized as things become more kind of depolarized. And the polarity is what creates like the frisson for a lot of people in that sense. And that's not to say we need to return, quote unquote, with the V, like return or whatever.
Return to Monk.
We don't need to return to Monk, no. We don't need to return to Monk. But I mean, but part of what we should be doing is trying to troubleshoot how we can sort of mitigate the sort of trade-offs that have occurred due to our rebellion against Mother Nature. And I feel like if we don't, we're just going to continue to see people get progressively more alienated from one another and unhappy and sexless. Because a lot of this new sort of female stars that are up and sort of elevated are fucking sexless. They don't have that same like powerful feminine sexual appeal that, you know, previous generations did. And it's the same thing with the men too. Like, there's a weird sexlessness, and that it has nothing to do with like androgyny or anything, because androgyny can be sexy. Of course it can. We've got Bowie, we've got Grace Jones, we have so many people, but there's like a distinct sort of sexlessness that kind of completely ruins the frisson in a way that's like weird and uncomfortable.
I'd probably disagree with you on the men there. I would say men have never been sexier in culture. As a gay man, River, maybe you can back me up on this. Like, there's never been Channing Tatums and like fucking Jason Momoas.
No,
like,
but they're not relevant.
There's so many of these like amazingly like
the relevant men like, now are like
in men now. No, whereas before you had Arnie and arguably Sylvester Stallone, but he was like a proper ugly muck.
No,
so
the relevant
really,
men now are like the Timothée Chalamets and like the fucking Armie Hammers, and like, you know, those are like the hot new stars. And there's something distinctly sexless, and there's no charisma or like libido there, in my opinion.
Well, no, the roided out like Jason Momoa, who was the other one that you said?
Channing Tatum. I don't know.
Channing Tatum, but like the Jason
He's
Momoa,
old.
Or just like the like super like muscly and just like to the extreme, like bodies that honestly, there's a reason that you don't see pictures of people who looked like that 75 years ago. And it's because like this is the first time that we've had this much like protein and anabolic steroids on demand.
HGH.
We have the technology.
And it's not like, I think like the hottest like kind of body is like a bit of like functional, like maybe like a little buff, but like functional muscle or something like that. It's this I think that's what straight guys think is hot. Like Jason Momoa is a straight guy's idea of like what a hot guy is.
Yeah, it's true. It's true. And that's not what I'm into.
Like,
I like Robert Pattinson. I think he's sexy.
There's actually a really fascinating study that they did, and they did it across like different cultures, even like isolated sort of tribes and certain parts of like Central Africa and stuff, where they basically determined that what a society deems like the most beautiful is actually just the most average.
Yeah.
The most average face, the most average sort of body. You know, so I think that, you know, that's why like the sort of like muscly thing, it's going to, I think that'll sort of phase out. because it's
we're not going to be able to cram even more protein and have even more muscles. Dwayne The Rock Johnson's going to look like a dwarf in comparison to whoever comes in 20 years time. It's going to be crazy.
So, yeah.
Oh God, no, I don't know. I don't find that hot. I'm in that sense, like for me, what makes a man attractive is his charisma, like his libidinal energy. Like he could be the most like ugly gremlin, weird, like skinny, spindly weirdo, but if he has like an energy to him that I find interesting, or like a just sort of a libidinal thing, then yeah, I'm into it. But yeah, I'm noticing that like more and more they're sort of giving us these sanitized, like sexless celebrities, even though we're supposed to be in this like hypersexual like age. Like someone like Taylor Swift, for instance, she's completely like sexless to me anyway. I think she's like completely like devoid of any kind of libido, you know? I don't know.
Yeah. And it even goes beyond celebrity to just normal people, because everything's so visual now, like because everybody meets on like Tinder or Grindr or like whatever. Yeah. There's so much that is like lost, I think, because like attraction is not purely like, is this person like photogenic? Like do they, it's not just like your facial symmetry or your body necessarily, although that's part of it. It's also voice. Voice is really important. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. I've went on dates with really hot guys that I'm just like, I can't stand. Like I can't deal with the voice. Your voice is horrible.
Yeah.
And charisma, smell, which is sort of, you can't really define that. And that doesn't charisma doesn't come across the same through like texting or like messaging. It just doesn't. And just like
smell
presence.
Too. I like to smell people. Smell is also like the pheromones.
A Biden
trait for sure.
There you go. Something you and Joe Biden have in
something
common.
Me and Joe Biden. I think it's because we're both Leo rising. So we like,
oh my
we like
God.
To smell. We like to smell people. Get a whiff of the pheromones. But yeah, voice, charisma, all kinds of different things. And just like genuine, like libidinal energy. Like when you're with someone who you know is like up for fucking. Like there's something super hot about that. But like everyone's like so inhibited now, especially in the heterosexual dimension. Because like, you know, I have so many friends who tell me like horror stories about like going on dates with guys who are like afraid to touch them because they're afraid that they'll be perceived as like, even though they're sending like all those signals.
Well, they're just stupid because they didn't bring their consent forms with them, did they? Bring the consent forms, you get them signed, bang. No legal course of action is like ever
going to
happen.
Oh my God.
Done.
But it's like, even though these women are literally like, spread eagle, like I'm available, like fuck me, the guys will still be like all like weird about it because they don't want to be treated like Aziz Ansari, and like
no one wants that bad date that turns you into a supposed rapist,
molesty bear.
Tragic, man. I do feel really sorry for that. He was the victim out of all of that.
Yeah, that was like such a disgrace. Like I don't understand what people's solution to this is. I also remember like back when the whole what did they call it, this was a big deal in like 2015, affirmative consent where they were like, or like I remember reading articles where they were like, if someone is above like the blood alcohol legal, like if they're not like legally too drunk to drive, they like they can't consent to sex. I was like, in that case I've been raped like thousands of times. You know,
wow.
Like, yeah, and it's just like, I don't think I have, you know, like
I think most humans, or a lot of humans at least, are then just the product of rape.
Yeah,
just like just a pretty grim way to view humanity.
Yeah. And then also just, you know, like I don't know, it is kind of like, it's hot to have like a little bit of like mystery in a date where you're like, is this going to happen? Is this not going to happen? You know, like,
yeah.
I mean, that's one of the worst things about like being gay in like the 21st century is like all of this is like contracted through like Grindr. It's like, I mean, like I get like an order, like a fucking Uber Eats order of like exactly what sex acts are expected to be performed. And like,
oh my
then I'm
God.
Sent like an address and then you go, and it's really mechanical and weird. And like that's even happening to straight people now, I think, to a certain extent. And is that safer? I guess. Is it less interesting? Does it make life duller? Absolutely.
Yeah.
I think you kind of have to have a trade-off. It's like, do you want to be safe? I mean, like, obviously, like, if you're, like, in a situation where, like, someone is, like, violently attacking you or, like, won't let you leave or whatever, like, that's a totally different situation than just, like, oh, this person may be uncomfortable. Well, like, you can either rectify that situation immediately, like an adult, or you can just, like, leave. You know, like, I feel like these aren't things that should be, like, they're intuitive.
Yeah, you know? But the thing is, we're sort of being sort of trained to ignore that subterranean sort of intuitive realm in favor of having everything be like spelled out for you. And especially with women, there's this weird desire for freedom, but then there's also a desire for paternalism. Like, we don't want to take adult responsibility for our sexuality, for reading social cues, for, like, you know, ensuring that we are, you know, knowing what we want, which is the thing, like, knowing what we want, like, and being able to communicate, especially women of a certain class, you know, being able to communicate emphatically what we want and what our boundaries are and stuff. And we sort of want, like, paternalistic figures to step in and, like, do that work for us, which is, like, really, like, I think that takes us back. I think that that's, like, not, like, a good thing. And I think it's really bad. But yeah, I can definitely see why people feel alienated from, like, sex and, like, gender and stuff now. And, like, I feel like people should always try, and I'm not talking about everybody, but I feel like people should troubleshoot this stuff and think about it and have conversations with it about it, rather than, like, you know, trying to sort of create labels. And I mean, it's not even just a non-binary thing. Like, kink now is like an umbrella, like you said, for all of the sort of feminine desires, those traditional feminine desires. Like, I found this thing called, like, a birthing kink, where women are saying that the idea of their, like, partner impregnating them is like a kink or turns them on, when that's like a very natural thing to feel. It's just like your biological clock. But it's more socially acceptable for it to be like a kink than for you to like accept the fact that you're a biological being, you know, who has certain like subterranean desires, you know?
Yeah.
It's like fucking, it's really annoying. It's better to just say it's a kink or take on some kind of label out of the alphabet or whatever the fuck in order to avoid doing the internal excavation.
It becomes your identity. You become the come in me gal.
Yeah, but you're the come in me. You're part of the come in me.
Yeah, well, I mean, it's almost impossible to find someone on the left in America, like a prominent person on the left, at least, who hasn't found some way to join, to like exit the oppressor class by adopting like one identity or another.
You
know, I mean, if you're like a minority, like a racial minority, it's kind of already baked into the cake. But if you're like, you know, just a straight white guy, well, you better think of something fast, because people will use it against you if you don't. And it's kind of understandable why people would just be like, yeah, I'm pansexual because I like, let a guy give me a hand job at a party when I was 22, or like I'm non-binary because I painted my nails once or whatever, because like, and I mean, like, I don't care. Like if you identify as non-binary and want me to use like they, them pronouns or whatever, I will do so. I might fuck it up because it's like difficult to retrain your brain to think in that way. I can't even really judge them, because if you're in that social milieu, you kind of have to do it, you know?
No, I disagree. Grow some fucking balls. Like,
well, I mean, you should grow some fucking balls.
If someone's saying, like, you're a fucking straight white man, then be like, Chad fucking yes, I'm a straight white man. I didn't ask to be who I am. And if you're going to then judge me based upon that presupposition, or say that I don't have the authority to have an opinion on something, then fuck you. And I feel like so many people are too afraid to just do that. And they're also afraid of being sort of barred institutional perks and institutional access, which is what it's really about. I don't think it's even rooted in fear a lot of the time. I think it's about getting the sort of credibility that would allow one to gain access to certain institutional perks and certain credibility, the sort of credibility to have an opinion, or the credibility it takes to sort of be able to become part of the quote unquote conversation. And I think it's such a stupid thing to try to adhere to. And there just doesn't seem to be enough people who are like, no, fuck that. Like, fuck that. Like, no, I'm not going to do that. I am who I am. Fuck you. It seems like with like men on the left, if you're not identifying as some form of like LGBTQ,
anything
you are
but masculine.
No, yeah, anything but
that,
masculine.
If that
you,
goes
but
back
if you
to
are
point,
if you are masculine, the way you get credibility is by trying to lord intellectual authority over people. So if you're a white man, you have to be the biggest brained Marxoid white man in order to be considered like viable. You have to have some form of academic credibility, and if you don't have that, then your only sort of route to being part of the conversation is to kind of like do this stuff. And it's
or you have to be constantly apologizing and being deferent,
yeah,
you know,
castrating yourself basically, and like making yourself like completely innocuous and constantly diminishing the authority of whatever it is you're trying to communicate by basically apologizing constantly. And yeah, people should grow some fucking balls, in my opinion. It's more dignified of a way to exist than like constantly apologizing or trying to sort of create this de facto intellectual authority or adopting an identity that's not really dealing with the problems that you clearly have.
And if the left were actually like interested in recruiting the working class into their movement, you think they would be willing to acknowledge that, you know, the sort of defense is always that actually it's like the working class isn't bigoted, blah 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 blah. And it's like I'm that's not like untrue. I grew up working class. I've been around working class. I'm around working class people all the time. I don't feel like they judge me for being gay, but it's also like, straight construction workers, or whatever, aren't going to fucking go to a gay bar. And if you've turned your communist organization into like not even a gay bar, because gay bars can be fun, like a lesbian coffee shop where people like read, their spoken word poetry and talk about how hard it is to be non-binary or whatever, like people aren't going to be they're not going to feel comfortable in that situation because and it's not because they're like bigots, it's because it's like not for them, like
I would even argue that having sort of misgivings about these new identities or questions, or wanting to know more, wanting to penetrate further, doesn't make somebody automatically bigoted either. Like, I refuse to even concede the premise that working class people are, quote unquote, that by saying that this would be a difficult thing for people to sort of get in line with or whatever, immediately means that you're saying that the working class is, quote unquote, bigoted. I don't know. I feel like that word gets thrown around like way too much.
on the insult for bigoted.
Exactly.
Gets swung around pretty quickly.
Yeah, way too much. Way too much. But anyway, moving on from the subject, we wanted to talk a little bit about Cuba and the stuff that's been going on there. And I've purposefully been avoiding creating a take because as soon as the protests started happening, you had like left Twitter and all the Marxoids and leftoids coming out of the woodwork to basically, repeat whatever received wisdom that they had and to be the first to have a take about this like incredibly sort of complex issue. And I wanted to like think about what I wanted to say before saying. And obviously, do you know what's going on there, River, at the moment? No, I was saying, do you know what's happening in Cuba at the moment?
Basically, there are protests because the standard of living has declined there substantially because of COVID, and the additional sanctions that were put in by the Trump administration, which, the effects are just sort of like coming to bear like full force now.
Yeah.
Because even though, like, it was already pretty dire, I mean, there was an embargo, you know, they just somehow, like, made things even worse. And, you know, people are upset that people are dying of COVID, that there's not enough money, that there's been, like, electricity outages and stuff like that. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. But it's being, like, cast in the U.S. media not as a sort of a gripe, if you will, about, like, material resources, but as, like, as a call for, like, freedom. And there are, or quote-unquote freedom, like, or the end of the Communist Party rule. And that's not to say that there aren't some people who are protesting who do want an end to the regime, but it's still tied into the material reality because, you know, even though it is, you know, the fault of COVID sanctions, for the most part, things beyond the Communist Party's control, the average person doesn't really think of it that way. I mean, you know,
exactly.
I mean, even in the United States, like when shit goes bad, like people blame the president, even if it doesn't mm-hmm. really have anything to do with any particular mm-hmm. policy or, you know, thing that the president did. If mm-hmm. the economy goes south, if there's some sort of pandemic or like, you know, whatever, the president's approval ratings go down, maybe there'll be protests. And so the Cuban expat community in Florida, which that's where I live now. I live close to the Alabama border, so I'm not in like deep Cuban territory, but I'm familiar with Cuban Floridians, and they it's very much like just permanently in the zeitgeist. It doesn't matter what their politics are on anything else. Like I always think of it as like with my family and my like upbringing, like strict Baptist, you know, all that anybody really in my family cared about was like, are they for or against abortion? Right. And that's kind mm-hmm, of how they, mm-hmm. That's like the sort of Cuban American like outlook.
Mm-hmm,
mm-hmm. And it's interesting to see the fallout from this. I saw an article earlier today where people are trying to kind of do some id poll shit where they're talking about their like Afro-Cubans are leading the protests or whatever. And it's like, I don't know if that's true. I kind of doubt it. But the fact that like this is something that's being pumped out and like circulated by the Cuban American community, which is a conservative community that always, I mean, Florida would be a Democratic Party controlled state if it weren't for the Cuban American vote. They're like one of the most like dedicated supporters of the Republican Party. They're not traditionally woke, but I think they are becoming that in a way because it's such a middle class demographic. I think they're, you know, entering these institutions and being like, okay, so we need to present it this way. We need to say that Afro-Cubans are, you know, leading the charge for freedom against the communist regime, when in reality, and everybody knows that the Cuban expat community is overwhelmingly white. I've never met, I've met many, many Cubans since I've started living in Florida. I've never met an Afro-Cuban, not even once.
It's interesting.
I mean, when I lost my
though,
Southern
because,
accent for the most part, people thought I was Cuban because I have like dark hair and like a Roman nose. I mean, it's, you know, these are white people and no one has benefited more in Cuba than the Afro-Cubans. I mean, most of them were completely illiterate and destitute before the Communist Party took control. They helped lead the Cuban Revolution, and because mm-hmm. they were still like existing in this like feudal plantation system,
mm-hmm.
I don't think mm-hmm. that like if you went to Havana and asked any Afro-Cuban whether or not they were better off under, you know, the U.S.-backed, like, Batista government, I mean, like, they would never have said yes, because, like, if they were alive at the time, at least, because, like, they knew, like, you know, how terrible the conditions were. And so to cast it in this way is, I think, really indicative of the time of the culture at large, and also the position that this traditionally conservative group in the United States, Cuban Americans, have found themselves in, where they've entered these middle class institutions, and now they're trying to tailor it to sort of appeal to that sort of liberal zeitgeist, especially with a Democrat in charge.
It's interesting, though, because Pitbull, Mr. Worldwide, came out with a statement. Should we play the clip? Hang on, let me just play the clip.
This is a message to the world. We need to stand up, step up, but if you don't understand what's going on, then you need to wake the fuck up. Not only is this a Cuba event, a Cuba thing, this is a world event. This isn't about politics. This is about saving lives. This is about unity, not division. And bottom line, this is about taking action. Let me tell you something, why I'm frustrated and when I see everybody out there and doing what they're doing, which I love what they're doing. Okay? Because not only do we live for freedom, we ride for freedom, we die for freedom, but we motherfucking appreciate freedom. And it gets me hot, it bothers me, and it frustrates me to a certain extent, being a Cuban American and having a platform to speak to the world and not being able to help my own people. Not being able to get them food, not being able to get them water, not being able to get them medicine. But most of all, not being able to help and really get them what they deserve, which is freedom. And this is my way of talking to the world. All world allies, get together to help. Global businesses, get together to help. People that we're so proud of, people such as a Jeff Bezos, Cuban American, graduated from a high school in Miami, built one of the biggest companies in the world, the richest man in the world. He's somebody that can get involved and really help us on what we got. All we can do is create awareness, but politics are gonna be politics. And while they figure out what they figure out, we need to figure out how to really help. We need to get creative. We need to figure out solutions while they're losing their lives over there, literally, for something that we wake up every day and appreciate, which is freedom. So to everybody out there, stand up, step up, and if you don't understand, get with the motherfucking program and wake up. Because this is about freedom and it's about human rights.
All right. Well, that was something.
Yeah, it was really something. From the mouth of Mr. Worldwide himself.
Mr. Worldwide. He references the world and the globe many times in that as well, which I felt was very fitting.
No, I mean, this, no, Pitbull is a CIA agent, and I don't say that just because of this. I have long thought this.
Oh my God.
Have you ever
spilled the tea?
Been hanging out with somebody, and they're, or on a road trip or anything, and somebody's like, hey, we should put on some Pitbull. Have you heard the new Pitbull album? No one has ever said that. And yet he's had just innumerable radio hits.
Yeah.
Mr. Worldwide. Okay, we see like the global cabal is right there. He introduces it in every song. It's all there. I mean, I remember he's so corny. I remember him, Chelsea Handler, that MK Ultra victim. I remember... or perpetrator, it's hard to tell, but I remember she had this show on Netflix, which I was excited for because Chelsea Lately was hilarious. It was a great show. She was mean, now she has Pitbull on the show. He's talking about a charter school that he's opened, and then Chelsea Handler and Pitbull proceed to rap together about charter schools. And this was the point at which I was like, oh no. I was like, something in the wind changed that day.
Yeah,
I was like, this is not good. This woman who made her career off of like talking shit about celebrities. She's banned from Serbia for making fun of the Serbian government. She had a special called Uganda Be Kidding Me, where her opening line is that Alaskans, they look Asian, but with a touch of the Downs. That this person is rapping with Pitbull about charter schools. I was like, shit about to turn in the culture.
It's all, it's all fake news. It's all fucking fake. It's all fucking bullshit. But like back to the whole like Cuba thing, you know, it's okay. Obviously what he's saying is cynical, and I mean, even the fact that he mentions Jeff Bezos is like a notable Cuban and calls for business to come and sort
it out. He's Norwegian.
Yeah. He's Norwegian.
Well, I just Googled his to fact check that Cuban. Because as soon as I heard him say that, I was like, yeah, his dad was a Cuban immigrant. So I don't know if you would classify Jeff Bezos as a Cuban American.
Cuban-American.
But he's not.
It feels like that's a... But I don't know. Like, he's not. I'm like...
His stepfather is Cuban. His biological father, his last name is Jorgensen. He's Norwegian.
Okay. Oh, wow. He's like Norwegian.
Right, so he's actually, he's like maybe just by association Cuban.
He's a Cuban-American.
He's Cuban by marriage.
By marriage. There we go. There we go. But yeah, okay, it's cynical. But my whole thing is it's the dominant narrative for most people. The most people don't, most people are not communists or even sympathetic towards the cause of like communism at all. And when they see, you know, the narrative around like starvation and lack of proper facilities and all that stuff has been so ingrained into the sort of American psyche that when they see stuff like this happening, they genuinely believe that these people are sort of fighting for freedom against like an oppressive, like undemocratic, like regime in that sense. And the people who are actually there on the ground, there's like a split. They're literally Cuban communists who are going out into the streets, attempting to sort of like quell people and tell them to continue to support, and you know, and also sort of tell them, you know, remind people of how terrible it, you know, capitalism is and all of this stuff. And then you have people, mostly people who are in the sort of newer generation, especially because of the proliferation of social media in Cuba now, who are sort of seeing the situation they're in as anti-democratic and as, you know, so it's difficult to come up, because the thing that annoys me is that I've been seeing a lot of like people in our like little online milieu or whatever, especially like on the left side of it, kind of having these takes that kind of seem insensitive towards the genuine feelings on the ground, divorced from the theoretical things that we know and our sort of ideals. You know, just sort of looking at the stark reality of how these people are feeling and where the sort of motivations that they're kind of expressing are coming from in that sense. And it's not like a both sides thing or like me trying to say that blah, blah, blah. It's more just like attempting to be realistic about how I view what's going on.
Well, in all fairness, like from what I've read, which is like, to be fair, not very much, but I did like Google stuff before and like looked up the situation, because it said like this guy was the leader of Cuba, but I saw that his name wasn't Castro, and I was like, oh my god, what happened? And so he was voted in like in 2018, but Castro's brother was still running shit until 2018. So they didn't vote for Castro's brother, right? Or was that voted in as well? Because from what I read, it felt like he inherited that role, kind of. So they've not really had like a democracy for a leader for, you know, decades, right? Or is that me like being totally ignorant and like I've got that totally wrong?
From my understanding, the way it works is the Communist Party, there's probably some sort of internal discussions among party members, but they sort of elect the leader, and they do have like a sort of like Congress of like members of the Communist Party. But I know they have like some sort of direct democracy stuff that they do, where like when they were writing a new constitution, I think a couple of years ago, they like sent like party apparatchiks out to like all the cities and like even like the small like little villages and stuff, and were like they would just gather everybody in like a school or a church or whatever, and they were like, okay, so what do you want? And they received like thousands of like requests of like, what would you like to see in the Constitution? And then they selected kind of like from those suggestions, like what should be added, which is like, is it democratic in the way that me in the US or you in the UK would understand? Like it's not the same
democracy,
but it is like, I mean,
and it's not as if we're coming from our democracies are like seamless either. So I do understand that a lot of the criticisms that come out of our nations are, especially like the sort of capitalist like elite of our nations, are bad faith. But in that sense, I don't want to jump the gun, because I feel like there are obviously issues on the ground in Cuba. Otherwise, this shit wouldn't be happening. And the embargo is also like a huge part of it as well. But like, I feel like a lot of people who are like us, like, you know, Marxists, communists, whatever, you know, are so quick to say that, no, there's nothing wrong. Everything's wonderful. Everything's fine. Because we feel like we have to defend this like one bastion of like communism that's like still around in a way that ends up sort of allowing us not to communicate our message in a way that would actually reach people, in a way that seems like we're bypassing the concerns that they may have. And I think that that's what makes somebody like Pitbull's message seem a lot more like appealing, well, you know, to also, the average person who doesn't know anything
also,
about anything.
Communist like Cuba, like today, is not communist Cuba of even 20 years ago, let alone 30 years ago. Oh, so it's the same in like China, where like it would be saying like China pre, you know, opening up to global markets and all the rest of it. That was like communist China, if you were going to really like make an argument for it. Yeah. But now it's just like state capitalism because they opened it up to everything.
Yeah.
And the same thing with Cuba.
Yeah, I mean, like this, I think the state still owns like the majority of like industry in the country, but it's, you know, I don't think that Pitbull's video, which, just to be clear, for those of you who haven't seen it, looks like one of those like anti-smoking ads that only makes you want to say more. Like that's like the vibe it had, even like the weird like filter that
black
they used
white.
On it, like that purpley haze, which is very strange, but. I don't think that's going to move the needle, but I do think that, you know, like if you grow up, I don't know how it is in the UK, but if you grow up in the United States, like all you're told your entire life is that Cuba is a, dystopian, like dictatorship.
No toilet paper.
Yeah. Like a 1984 style thing where like people are like afraid to like say anything. But then they'll like, to prove this, they will like go to Cuba and like interview people, you know, complaining about the government. And it's like, okay, well, obviously it's not that dystopic or they wouldn't be able to complain about it to like a camera. But nonetheless, I think people are already kind of primed to be like, oh, well, if this is what people want, then sure, let them have it. And I think it's kind of more torn on like, I don't think that there are people who are like calling like the mayor of Miami calling on like on Biden to like order the military to invade Cuba. I don't think Americans want that.
Yeah. No. No.
We don't want a war in our own backyard.
Pitbull is calling Jeff Bezos to come and captains of industry to come and solve the problem. So, like, you know, even the reverse to that is this sort of cynical, like neoliberal incursion into, you know, this like into the affairs of Cuba in that sense. So
only neoliberal capitalism can save that.
Yeah, only neoliberal capitalism is capable of like solving the problems and blah, blah, blah. That's like sort of the counter narrative that's been being pushed, which I definitely don't agree with either. But I feel like the way we communicate things as people who believe in certain ideals or have certain, whose worldviews are informed by things like Marxism, I feel like we have to be kind of careful to not sort of seem completely out of touch, in my opinion, you know, or as if we're sort of doing, we're like kind of reluctant to criticize any sort of regime that calls itself communist out of fear of like, you know, decrediting or discrediting like the communist ideal, which I feel. Yeah, go on. Sorry.
Oh, yeah. Well, I was just going to say, I mean, like, that's true. Like, I mean, there, I'm not going to, no, like, government is, like, I'm not a utopian, you know?
Yeah,
like,
exactly.
I think that socialism is probably a better system in most regards when it comes to most things. But I, you know, this idea that, like, you're ever going to live in a perfect society, I'm sorry, it's just not true. But
yeah.
I think, you know, people don't really understand, and I think even a lot of, Cuban Americans who are like second or third generation. I mean, I remember talking to like a Cuban guy. What was he? His grandparents came here like after the revolution or something. And he was like talking about, he was like, well, we just want our democracy back. And I'm like, you never had one. What are you talking about? Yeah. Cuba was never a democracy.
Yeah. No.
Like there's, I mean, even if Cuban Americans don't know that, at least the younger ones, I mean, regular like Anglos and like black people and like whatever, like certainly don't know. The truth is like Cuba was a colony of the United States and in some periods of time, a literal colony. And for most of the 20th century though, just figuratively, like, I mean, like the entire country, for the most part was owned by American foreign interests, all of the major industries, oil, agriculture, everything. And so the Cuban Revolution, it wasn't just to overthrow the Batista regime, which was, you know, awful and repressive and violent, but it was and corrupt, but it was also a war of independence from the United States.
Yeah.
And I don't think that the CIA or anybody in like the American institutions have forgotten that, if even though everybody else seems to have.
That's very true. That's
and
very
I think
true.
That they and when you hear like, you know, Pitbull, as corny as he is, saying like we need industry to step in, I mean, because I can tell you what will probably happen, because it's what's happened all over the former communist or still maybe communist in name countries, is that private industry will come in. You'll have this massive influx of capital. You'll probably be like a crash like you had in maybe like the Soviet Union or something, like where people are just, everything is worse. But you will see like this massive growth of a class which can take power and hold power. And, you know, for a while it will seem like everything is okay. But then when you look back 20 years, you're like, oh, maybe things aren't better, you know?
Yeah, it's true. It's true. And that's sort of what you've seen, like you said, occur in a lot of other different places as well. It's just, what worries me is like the Western sort of left, or there is no actual like Western left, but people who are sort of intellectually inclined that way in that sense, the way that they sort of fetishize internationalism in this like really sort of pernicious way that ends up not really engaging with like the realities that are on the ground in places that they have no connection to and they have never been. So you have like these Cuban Americans on one side who are like not even like properly embedded in Cuba, Cuban culture, and are just sort of mouthpieces for like American state propaganda. And then on the other hand, you have these like leftoids who are sort of like, you know, using this sort of fake internationalism as like a signaling mechanism among themselves to show how communist they are and how much they like support, you know.
Well, of course they've got food shortages. They don't even have a Whole Foods. how are they expected to feed the people?
Yeah,
but go back to your point with like him being a CIA op. I also noticed something about the video that was kind of suspicious as well, because I mean, this is Mr. Worldwide. He has nearly 15 million subscribers on YouTube. That's big fucking numbers. This video was released a week ago.
Yeah.
And it has less than 75,000 views.
Wow.
But it's still being talked about, like, in the news. We're talking about it fucking now. Like, you know? Yeah. Like, but it has, you know, that's suspicious.
It is sus.
It's weird. It's like
sus.
they're the exact 75,000 views you would need to be, like, talked about
Yeah.
Well, it hasn't reached like the main, like, you know, whatever.
Viral.
Yeah, of YouTube.
I think that the deep state, to borrow like a Trumpian phrase, which is also true. I think that the sort of deep state, CIA and like the State Department, and all of that. I mean, all of these people do subscribe to a sort of like liberal utopianism. Like, we don't think of mm-hmm, liberalism mm-hmm. as a utopian idea. But mm-hmm. it is, and it always mm-hmm. was. You know, you had to have some sort of ideology to combat the Marxist ideology, which was a real threat during most of the 20th century. And so yeah. it became this idea of a sort of like cult of the individual, where the individual is the center of the world, and like any government, the main purpose of like government should be to empower the individual. And in some respects, I think that modern American liberalism is so much more adept and so much more like adheres to that ideology so much more than even like Ayn Rand did, because Ayn Rand was like, her whole thing was, you know, basically there should be almost no government. You should have like a state, mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. like a military and like an army to protect mm-hmm. like individual rights. And that was like pretty much it. But the sort of liberal idea is not only should the state step away and let people empower themselves, which is the sort of libertarian or like objectivist Ayn Rand sort of idea, but that the state should actually invest in people developing their own, you know, individual desires and wants, and like mm-hmm, basically mm-hmm. like state funded atomization and social engineering. I think that's kind of what we're seeing, and there hasn't been, it's been a long time since they've been able to push that again. I mean, they did it with Iraq. I mean, that was the whole idea, right? Is that we have to liberate Iraq. We have to like free these people so that they can, you know, elect a democratic government so that they can have individual rights. So women can, you know, be empowered or whatever, even though that wasn't really an issue there. They tried to do it with Syria mm-hmm. by funding the, you know, moderate rebels who didn't exist. And that didn't really work out because the American people didn't have a taste for it. They didn't want another war in the Middle East. So they just subcontracted it all out to, you know, Blackwater and like all these private security firms. And now mm-hmm. they're trying to do it with Cuba. Because one, it serves a political constituency in the United States, which is very powerful because Florida's a populous state, it's a swing state, and also allows like this sort of liberal like utopianism to spread and to be like reinvigorated, because even though the average person, like the average American, isn't really concerned with like, well, what is our like point as a country? What is the point of America? They don't really think mm-hmm. about that. But if you're in one of these institutions, if they have dedicated your entire life and career to protecting and rectifying and reproducing these institutions, you have to have some sort of justification for it. Mm. And that's where this comes from.
Yeah, it's interesting though, because it's shifting. And I know that you mentioned that they were sort of trying to use this like wokeness is like this sort of black Cubans that were leading the thing. They're sort of using it as a sort of moral cover for their agenda. One of the things that because I'm working on a video at the moment about critical race theory that should be out soon. And one of the, while studying critical race theory, one of the things that I realized is that it's a complete attack on those sort of noble liberal ideals, things like equality under the law, things like sort of bourgeois freedoms and rights, like freedom of speech, all of this stuff. It's like an attack on the entire sort of like liberal frame. And like through kind of reading the sort of Marxist critiques of liberalism, what I sort of garnered from it is that Marx was sort of not critiquing the noble ideals of liberalism themselves. He was critiquing the contradictions within like liberal bourgeois society and believed that, you know, communism was the only way to sort of reach those noble liberal ideals in that sense. Whereas something like critical race theory and all these different like disparate woke ideologies are a complete assault on the liberal ideals themselves. So things like bourgeois freedoms become superfluous so long as it's in service of like wokeness. And then you're also seeing this ideology being integrated into the national security state with like Biden's war on domestic terror and also the way that they're sort of using wokeness as the new sort of liberal utopian ideology that is justifying like the US operations abroad in that sense. So like I don't blame people who are skeptical about the assault on what they perceive as like liberal noble ideals, not necessarily like the contradictions in bourgeois society themselves. And I sometimes worry that like Marxists get like lost in the weeds where they think that we are against the noble ideals of liberalism rather than against the like contradictions within like liberal bourgeois society, which is really what Marxism is supposed to be like a criticism of. And, you know, like I said, things like critical race theory are literally an assault on things like legal proceduralism, equality under the law, all of the sort of bourgeois freedoms, the small sort of bourgeois freedoms that we have at the moment. And like, yeah, I think we should be invested in like protecting and upholding those by whatever means that we can. In that sense, and I don't blame people for being skeptical about this sort of ontological like incursion that we're seeing, especially because it's become state ideology and it's sort of justifying a lot of like the way that the Cuban Americans are justifying their, you know, de facto like capitalist incursion is by saying it's being led by Black people or whatever the fuck. Like, it's pretty hegemonic and effective.
Right, but and I feel like it may be different for you in the UK because I know you'll have, like, there's no First Amendment, right? But in the United States, like, we have, like, the First Amendment and all these other, like, freedom of association and, like, all sorts of other things that, like, sort of stop critical race theory from being able to exert its power, like, this sort of, as you said, like, anti-liberal aspirations or whatever, through the legal system. So it just gets filtered through the institutions, and you know, so you can get fired if you're not like with it, you know, or whatever. Mm-hmm, if you say something that's like not correct or whatever, you can get fired, but they can't throw you in jail. So it's like in the sort of American psyche, it's just like, oh well, that's just how it is, because we don't have, there's no legal sort of, I guess, like, I don't know, they, like, in the sort of American liberal, like, ideology, like, the, whatever, a private corporation pretty much do can anything do whatever it wants. Besides, like, kill you. Yeah. And, like, it's fine. Like, they can just, like, it's, they have the freedom to associate with you or not, and, like...
Yeah. They can harvest you for, like, adrenochrome if they so choose.
Right.
If you sign up for that.
The way, the way that critical race theory actually works in practice is it just becomes a sort of tool of the managerial elite, a way to cultivate status. It's I wrote an article for TwinkRev called The Standpoint Bureaucracy, which isn't really just about like CRT, but it's about, you know, this, the whole proliferation of different identities and how people in the professional classes are able to use them to get to have and to speak on behalf of other people. And it's just a machine. It doesn't actually, it's still an individualized project, because if you are, you know, the Black lady at the New York Times or whatever, it doesn't really matter what you write, because one, you're not speaking to Black working class people, because that's not who buys the New York Times. You, the money that you get paid is not being distributed to, you know, gas station employees in Mississippi. It's going straight to you. And it's just like like all these people who are it's just replicating the sort of liberal institutions that we already have, which are representational. So, you know, you have your district and then you have your representative from that district. We're just doing that now in the private institutions like corporations and such with ethnic minorities. So here's the gay representative. Here's the Black representative. So it gives like an illusion of empowerment to those groups of people, just as having, you know, your congressman in Congress is supposed to, he's there to represent you. Just like Hannah Nicole Jones or whatever is like here to represent Black women at the New York Times. But it's like, it's all bullshit either way, because your representative doesn't really represent you. Your representative represents the interests that he's beholden to, which are typically corporate.
Yeah, and Hannah Nicole Jones yelled at me on Twitter a few days ago. I don't know, it was like a few weeks ago, the 1619 lady, she got mad at me because I was like criticizing CRT, and she was like, well, you don't even know what it is. You've not read the sacred texts, and you haven't done the work. And I was like, fuck off. But anyway.
How can you be a master if you've not taken the trials?
Exactly. No, but it was very much like the thing that sort of is the most pernicious about it is that a lot of the people who are sort of wrapped up in this mode are sort of like self-professed Marxists. And even some of the Marxists who also have a certain amount of credence or credibility tend to like cover for a lot of this shit, and they're not like looking at it critically enough a lot of the time, which is really annoying. Part of my major issue is like, you know, because critical race theory is sort of linked to critical theory and like deconstructionism, it's sort of a bastardization of it. And academic Marxism in and of itself has already been bastardized to shit. And that's like a process that's been going on for a very long time. You know, the major gatekeepers are being purposefully uncritical. And one of the major blind spots is that they're sort of missing is the fact that CRT is a full-on assault on those noble, like, liberal ideals. And it's sort of, that's their ultimate aim, even though at the moment it's working through corporations and it's working in this sort of a subliminal kind of subterranean way. The overall goal is to basically overtake every single institution. It's a complete ontological like incursion, and it's also like the perfect sort of moral cover for class contradictions. It's the perfect sort of like layer of smoke above to sort of mystify like everything that's going on in terms of like the class contradictions and the class antagonisms that are occurring at the moment. And I don't think that there's been enough critical attention sort of turned towards that sort of towards this sort of thing. And it's quite annoying also when I see people who should be critical of it covering for it. Not just for CRT, for all forms of bourgeois ideology, all of this sort of identity stuff. You know, people just seem to be doing apologia for it rather than like contending with it, which is what Marxism is supposed to be. It's supposed to be like a demystification of bourgeois ideology and like a demystification of the contradictions that like exist within this sort of bourgeois liberal society that we're in.
Yeah, well, it tries to become a sort of Rosetta Stone for seeing the world, or like a totalizing worldview. And Marxism is for a lot of Marxists fall into the same trap. When you have Marxists, I just remember that insane DSA Queer Caucus video where they're saying like, before capitalism, most of the working class was actually queer and it was repressed by bourgeois society. And I'm like, that's not fucking true.
No,
it's just not. It's ahistorical.
What
it's not
are you
fucking
saying?
True.
Yeah.
Like, what are you talking about? Like
They do think they found like a Rosetta Stone.
Yeah.
And they sort of treat it like a religious orientation, and they create their own like weird Hotep cosmology around these sort of ahistorical claims, and it's disturbing.
And like, well, my thing with CRT is like, it's actually like within like the sort of realm of academia, it could be like a useful tool to a certain extent. Like, if you want to look at how race played a role in, housing in the United States or something, or like you want to like try to figure out why were there like housing disparities or whatever. Like,
but it's the overfocus on disparities that's the problem, because the desire to eliminate disparities basically takes away from the desire to like get rid of the conditions that create disparity in the first place. And their overfocus on disparity is, hey, if there's like, you know, if there's an equal amount of poor working class black and white people that don't have healthcare, that's fine, so long as there's like an equal proportion of black and working class white people who do have healthcare. Like the disparity thing is, it's a red herring, which is the reason why I don't even see a use for CRT at all. Like, I think it's like literally like Satan and it's come from hell.
Yeah. Smells like sulfur.
It smells like sulfur. Yeah, it smells like sulfur.
A lot of it is like, it's really like, it's sort of called CRT, but it's really just like history with, it's really just doing good history. Like, if you like, because to me, like, you know, explaining why there are like, why black people and white people like, or black people are like less likely to own houses, to like own their home or whatever in the United States. Mm-hmm. Like, it's fine to ask that question and look into the history and try to explain it as like an academic practice. Right.
Mm-hmm.
But then when your kind of solution becomes, well, you know, we just need to like rectify that by just like creating or recreating or expanding like the black middle class, as opposed to, you know, some sort of societal level project, I think that's where, you know, that's where I start disagreeing.
But that's the thing, is it's not even like asking the questions about disparities isn't necessarily CRT. Like, what CRT is the conclusions that are drawn, the sort of haphazard conclusions that are drawn from observing these disparities. And it can be really alarming to look at disparities on the surface, but without fully contextualizing that information, they sort of come up with these racialized explanations, these solely racialized explanations. And even the view of history views history through this solely kind of racialized lens, in a way that lends credence to things like racial essentialism. It's very disturbing. And it's all part of this like ontological overhaul that we're seeing. And that's the reason why I'm careful in terms of like my criticisms of liberalism, because of course, like as a Marxist, you're supposed to criticize the contradictions that exist within bourgeois liberal society, for sure, because liberalism doesn't live up to the ideals that it like proposes. And that's what we want those ideals. We want to live up to those ideals. I want equality under the law. I believe in those ideals very deeply. But it seems as if people are kind of in the process of kind of throwing the baby out with the bathwater with their criticisms and analysis.
And you
some
can't,
of the time.
And you can't look at things like purely, I don't think you can ever really look at things through like a purely racial lens either, because even though you can make the argument, and I wouldn't even necessarily disagree, that like there is or was a system of white supremacy in this country that like for the most part kept black people down. But you can't just pretend that that was a universal thing, or that or negate the existence of a black elite. The Jim Crow existed, was created, really, with the explicit permission of the black elite, with the Atlanta Compromise, Booker T. Washington. I live like two blocks from like, I don't want to dox myself, but I can we get that? I live like pretty close, you know, there's schools and streets all over this country named after Booker T. Washington. He basically sold black people out. And he said, you give money to black bourgeois institutions, you give money to like black colleges and black businesses, and Southern blacks will accept not being able to vote, terrible economic conditions, as long as you provide them with a primary. I think that was the one other thing they demanded was that black children be allowed to go to public school, which of course, even for poor white people in the South, I mean, I think if even people in this country don't understand, but foreigners especially don't understand, the South was, the rural South, was essentially a third world country until the 1970s. My grandparents grew up without electricity or running water. They were born in the 1950s, you know?
Wow.
And so, like, once you get onto these really rural parts, like, there was nothing. You know, my great-grandpa dropped out of school in the third grade to go work on a railroad because his dad had skin cancer that was eating his face up, and they had to go, he had to go work on a railroad when he was like 10 to buy him morphine so that his dad would, so he could knock his dad out so he could go to sleep at night, because otherwise his dad would just like scream in pain. And was not a totally, I've met old people from like my hometown and stuff who are like basically illiterate. Because like so many people, if you were poor, you didn't get to go to school. And these are white people I'm talking about. And so, course, like even, you know, if you were a black sharecropper in the 1920s, you weren't going to school past like the third grade.
Yeah.
You know,
it's true.
So
it's true.
You know, once you take class out of this equation and you just start viewing things, especially the more recent history, in an entirely racialized lens, it's not just pernicious in the way that it divides the working class amongst itself, but it's also ahistorical, and it's not good scholarship.
No, it's not good scholarship at all. But according to CRT, viewing things in an objective, measured academic fashion is white, because all academia is considered like white institutions. It's all white thinking. And if you adopt those traits, even if you're a black academic, that makes you politically white. So it's an ontology that cancels out any sort of measured criticism of itself, because whiteness is like the source of all evil. But I don't want to spoil it. I got a video coming. I'm working on it. It's cooking. It's in the process. But thank you so much for coming on, River. It was great. It was fucking long overdue. And I'm sorry I've been such a scatterbrain about it.
No, it's fine. I forgot to.
It's all good. Sorry, I've been such a scatterbrain about it. But thank you so much for coming on. It's been long overdue. And yes, feel free to come back anytime you want again. Do you want to let everyone know where they can find you, where they can find your articles, as I sort of botched your introduction?
You can find me on Twitter at @riverisnice_each word. And you can find my articles on twinkrev.com or on Splice Today.
Thank you so much. And thank you so much to you guys in the audience for listening. We hope you enjoyed this episode, and we shall catch you later. Goodbye.
Bye.
Bye.
Thank you so much, River. That was awesome.